Okay, good afternoon, everyone, and this is Ben and Bakay here on the Ben and Bakay Show on KVPI Radio, Real Black. We always have a special guest. This time we have an extra special guest. He's an icon in Real Black of Ashland Parish politics. Judge, District Attorney, Mr. Elo Fisley. Mr. Elo, thank you so much for coming on the program.
First of all, Benny, thank you for your taking your time to interview me, to go over the a little bit of my life from the time that I started school to the present time. First of all, and secondly, I was born here in Ville Platte.
Uh-huh.
I was on September the 15th, 1926. Two months earlier, my grandfather, who was the father of Evangeline Parish, old Colonel Fontenot, died 2 months before I was born.
Okay.
So I have a lot at stake in Evangeline Parish. I love my place, Ville Platte, Evangeline Parish, the state of Louisiana, with unbridled passion.
You know, Mr. Elo, since I'm a very young boy, I always heard, and you know, I'm not trying to flatter or anything like that, but that you were brilliant. You finished school at an early age. You went on to law school. You just about set records as a graduate of law school.
I did do that in several instances.
Okay.
For example, when I was almost 5 years old in September, school started in the late August or early September. I wasn't 5 years old yet.
Uh-huh.
I was just four. So then my father put me in Sacred Heart. My father was my role model. He pushed me to become a lawyer. And he told me, I want you to be a lawyer and I want you to be a district attorney one of these days.
So even at that young age?
At young age.
Yeah.
And I went to Sacred Heart in the depth of the Depression.
Uh-huh.
The Great Depression. When there was just no money to have. Cotton was selling at five cents a pound. A big 500-pound bale of cotton would bring $25. So a poor sharecropper that would make, say, 10 bales of, 9 or 10 bales of cotton, he maybe had 6 bales for himself and 1/3 to the landowner. So his whole year was for maybe $300. And, or less, because they'd raise corn, but it was not for sale. It was not a cash crop. It was for to feed their animals and to send it to the grit mill for a corn meal. And sweet potatoes, the same thing. It was for their own use. Sugar cane as well. It was to make that old black syrup.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget, it passed with wagons of this big blue ribbon. Sugar cane, which they don't make anymore because they were too easy to be weaveled. But the big blue ribbon cane, we'd go out there and pluck one out of the wagon for us to eat.
Uh-huh.
And chew the sugar cane. So I went on to the Sacred Heart that first year. In the second grade, my father was caught in the recession like everybody else. Couldn't afford $2 a month tuition to put me in Sacred Heart. So put me in public school where I stayed and graduated at Ville Platte High in 1942.
Okay.
I was blessed with some good school teachers in the elementary with Mr. Ellis Dupree and Mr. Hayes Artico.
Yeah.
They were my school teachers. And Judge Fugier had made a history, American history contest for Evangeline Parish for the 7th and the 11th grade. At that time, there was only 11 grades. So I went and I was a contestant for Mr. Hazer Artigo in the parish in the 7th grade. In those days, elementary was 7th grades and a freshman was 8th grades.
Oh, okay. Well, I didn't know that. And my mom and dad talked about those days to me. But they never told me the 7th grade was the splitting point. I grew up the 8th grade.
Yeah, I know. this was, that's why I finished a little bit early in high school. But anyway, the history, American History Contest was held for the 7th grade and the 11th. I was contesting for the 7th grade. Mr. Hazel was my tutor. And I won the 7th grade history contest parish-wide, but what Judge Cruzier had done. So when I went into high school and got into American history class and world history, it was Mrs. Zulma LaBarre. Everybody didn't want to go to her class. She had a little history class of about 8 or 9 people, and other school teachers were teaching American. I found out about her, and I wanted to learn, because she was a tough school teacher, Ms. Zulma.
But that was a lot to be learned.
I went to Prof. LaFleur. I said, Prof, I want you to transfer me out of that other history class to go to Mrs. LaBarre's. But he said, you mean you want to go to Mrs. LaBarre's class? He said, nobody ever asked me to do that. He said, you're wrong. So he put me with Mrs. LaBarre. She found out I had won that history contest in the 7th grade. She says, I'm going to take you, and we're going to win that 11th grade contest. He says, we got to beat Father DeBlanc, who was the history teacher
Sacred Heart.
Sacred Heart. So I says, well, we're gonna try. So sure enough, I took French and American history and world history with her. And we took the contest for the 11th grade American history contest that George Fugier was sponsoring. So sure enough, I won the thing. And that same day I won it, they were having registration for the sugar ration during for the war.
Okay.
So the school teachers were volunteering to help register the people. So I went to the gymnasium. I found out the school board office was in the old courthouse. I found out I had won about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. So I ran quickly from there to the school gym to tell Miss Zulma that I had won. That lady was so proud, she caught me by my arms this way and raised me up. The champion history contestant in Evangeline Parish. I was
red as though you were a trophy.
Yeah, I was small. My face got red as a beet. I was so ashamed that she had done that. Anyway, I went on to graduate, and I was valedictorian of my class in the 11th grade. And also in the 7th grade, I was the first one in the 7th and the 11th. So Prof. LaFleur was tutoring me on my valedictory address. I'll never forget it. It was the general thing about commencement, finishing high school, going forward. But it was a dedication to all. It just started in 1942. Prof. LaFleur was an ultra-patriotic man, if you remember.
He was my principal also, so I certainly do remember it.
He was the most patriotic teacher I had ever seen. So he made me recite the poem about that wounded soldier in World War I that had lost his mind, and they call it Whispering Bill. So I had to recite that whole long poem about Whispering Bill. From it started off with the censor taking. He says, so you take this wounded soldier, said, so you take in the census, mister, there's 3 of us left, my wife and I, and Whispering Bill. That was the beginning of the poem. So I went, I graduated in 1942. I was just 15 years old, because I would have been 16 in September. So I was going to go to LSU. I had gotten a scholarship to go at LSU. And my father and mother took me to Baton Rouge to LSU. I weighed 85 pounds. I was 4 feet 10 inches tall at 15 years old. So when they let me down, the first thing they did, they made me buy a cap. They cut my hair
Oh, yeah.
She was skull my mother was crying. I could see her crying in the car, and Daddy was laughing, having a great time of it. He took off my shoes, and he put my socks on my ears, and put me the little cap, and they had a dog, they had a real dog fusilier on it. So I took my little suitcase and went on into the Pentagon barracks, where you were required in those days to be in the military for 2 years. Then after that, if you wanted to go on and become a four-year military student, you could, but I just took 2 years. But it was like the army, and that first summer, I came back one time in that summer. So they only let you come back one time in the semester, that summer semester. Other than to stay on that campus, and they would haze me. They did all kind of things, the seniors, the upperclassmen. And they had to honor my uniform, my little gray uniform, tailor-made. They couldn't fit me, so I had to have a tailor-made uniform. Everybody else, they had their sizes. They could do it, but not me. I had to have my little uniform tailor-made. So we went along in my undergraduate work from that June till May of 1945. I got my 4 year bachelor's degree in that length of time. But during the war, you must remember, they were pushing it like heck.
Hurry up, hurry up.
Hurry up to get it, to try to get those boys educated before they went to the service. Uh-huh. You see, I was so young, by the time that I got to be 18 years old, I was drafted in 1945. The war was over, just about, you know. So they turned me down. They said that I was medically unacceptable. They claimed it with my feet that were very weak. So anyway, I graduated in May of 1945 with my degree. I immediately went on into law school in Baton Rouge. So from there, from that June of 1945 till August of 1947, I was in law school. 2 years.
Wow.
I finished 3 years in 2 years. In 2 years. Got my BA degree, my LLB degree in August of 1947. It's an interesting thing. That's a side issue. When it got to be in spring of 1947, Dean Abar called up for him. I said, now what does he want to be for? I didn't know what the hell he wanted. He said, Mr. Fusilier, I see that you need about 10 hours to graduate. I said, yeah, that's about right, Dean Abar. I said, I'm going to have to probably go that summer and go a short semester in the fall of 1947. He said, that's what I was telling you about. There's a special program going on that you are limited to take 7 hours during that summer in law school. That's all you could take. So I would have been three hours short. He says, Mr. Bill Dodd, who's my classmate, is the same boat as you. He needs 3 hours more than he can take that summer. And he has to get out by summer. I said, he says, if you want to study, stay an additional 3 weeks, we'll let you take the whole 10 hours.
And save a semester. Indeed.
So I can get out in August instead of having to wait till January of 48. I said, well, I just got married. I said, I certainly want to get out and start practicing law. Unbeknownst to me, Earl Long wanted Bill Dodd to run as lieutenant governor. He was the president of the NEA. He was a veteran of the European War. I mean, he was a natural to run with Earl.
Okay, Mr. Ello, we're going to take a quick break. Folks, y'all stay with us. We're going to be back in just a few moments. Okay, folks, we're back here on KVPI Radio, Mr. Ello, please continue with the stories.
So Sam Jones picked that up, special class created for by governor alone for Bill Dodd so he can run for the big to do about it. So I got caught in this turmoil, but being in the news without even knowing the problem we were in special class. And it was true, it was a special class. Old Earl put the pressure on.
But then it gave you, unbeknownst to you, some notoriety.
Yeah. From that time, statewide, that I was part of the Bill Dodd class because D.N.A. Barr made a special consideration for Bill to run for lieutenant governor by being pressured by Earl K. Long. So anyway, I came back over here, opened up my office in the Evangeline Bank, the second floor, where KVPR
had been.
It was at that time. So during the hours, just started practicing. During the holidays, Judge Tate, Albert Tate, met my older brother Joffrey. He says, you know, he says, my boy is graduating from LSU law school this January the 1st. He's going to want to come back over here to practice law. By the way, I had to take the bar exam. There was 12 of us from LSU that took it at that time. Only 6 passed it. It was tough. 3 days. But anyway, Joffrey says, I agree that's a good idea, Mr. Tate. I'll talk to my brother. So I said, sure. I liked Al very much, and he was a very crackerjack, probably the smartest man I ever had dealings with, because he could talk on the phone, make notes, and read a book at the same time. How the heck he could do that, I don't know.
He could divide his thoughts that readily?
Wow. Albert Tate Jr. was a genius.
Yes,
I'm telling you, a legal genius, as time proved out later. And so we started practicing law together. And Albert, you know how you push, Mr. Albert. Uh-huh. He says, y'all can't make it up there. I'm going to build you young boys an office on the first floor next to the main tower of Flywell, where Susan Court is.
Right.
So he built us an office there so we could be on the ground floor.
Didn't want y'all upstairs in real flat.
And he did it upstairs in real, but he wanted us to downstairs. So we opened up right down Court Street. The first year, you know, law practice is a different kind of a thing. To make money, you have to have a backlog. You know, it might take a year or so before you can make a dime on a case, get a case, and fool with it, so forth and so on, file a suit, get it tried, collect it. It might be a year, 16 or 18 months before you can get any money. Or you could, so those first, that first year, we didn't have any backlog. We had every little crumb we could make by cash sales, a little collections. We even took our leases at $1 an acre for a man by the name of P.C. Bundy. He was taking leases all over Belair Hole, and so we'd go with him to talk in French. I could talk in French and with those people, and to take leases, paying them $1
per acre.
Per acre. For a 5-year period, $1 every year to renew the lease. On a 1/8, now it's 1/6 or 1/5, and heck.
And we know the price of oil.
A world of money to take a lease now.
Mr. Ello, I'm curious about something. Your dad was very ambitious for you.
Oh.
Was he that ambitious for your brothers and sisters, or did he recognize?
See them all to school.
Okay.
Every one of them, my 3 older sisters, went to Natchitoches to be school teachers.
Okay.
I'll never forget the road between Turkey Creek and the cows there was a gravel road. And when it would rain in those hills, I'll never forget that one time I was bringing one of my sisters back to Natchitoches to go to school, to college there. And we had to go. It was money. That car, that old Mont-Lave that Daddy had, would just swirl,
fishtail back.
It would slip and slide all over those hills, those red hills between Turkey Creek and Lake Bayacocotri, clear water. It was a rough road. Then when we got to 71,
then you had a good state highway going north,
right. Went to Natchitoches. So, but coming back to Judge Jane and I, that first year of business, we made only $1,800 each. That's all. I didn't even own a car at that time at all. And when we had to go somewhere else, Albert gave his son Albert a car, an old Chevrolet. So we had that car to go if we had to go to Opelousas or whatever. And we practiced law together. But the second year and third year, our business zoomed. Mm-hmm. People began having confidence in us as lawyers. You know, when you just come up, people are afraid to put that.
They don't know how confident you are. Y'all prove. You have to prove
yourself a little bit. By the second and third year, we were proving ourselves. High class people were starting to hire to do complicated cases. So, by the time of 1954. We had a real good practice law. We were debating, at that time, we were debating two things. One, to open up a branch office in Lafayette, because our business was that good, we wanted to expand. But we also had another ambition. I sensed a revolution was coming. That Mr. Gurry was one of the greatest lawyers around here, a wonderful prosecutor, but I felt he had lost touch with the people, mm-hmm. and there was a revolution coming. Ken had been elected governor. Voting machines were there. The black people started to vote. Mm-hmm. Women. It was a wide open affair. I sensed that a revolution was coming. And Earl Loam, on the other hand, was after Al to run for the Court of Appeals, because Ken had appointed a Judge Kavanaugh. And the governor alone wanted to run for governor again in 1956. In those days, you could only run for one term. But he had gotten elected in 48 to 52. Then Kennan, then he wanted to run in 1956 against whoever would put up the run. I forgot who ran in 1956 against him. Oh, Sam Jones. He came back to run after. See, he was elected. In Sam Jones was elected in 1948
okay.
to 1952. That's the way it was. And then, so in 1952, Kennan appointed Kavanaugh, and Earl was prepared to run for governor in 1956. So he comes. He wanted Judge Ruggier or Al to run, but Judge had to run for re-election. For the district judge, he couldn't run. But Al says, "If you want to govern," he says, "I'll run." He says, "You think you can win, son?" He said, "With your help and my work," he said, "I think we can." And of course, I was running for district attorney. Because, like I said, I sensed the revolution. Mr. Fury was a great lawyer, don't get me wrong. I was taking on the establishment, the big establishment of the sheriff's office and all the courthouse, probably the town administration, the whole works. But they didn't know. My Uncle Lee and Parker Fusilier and Uncle Matt.
Mr. Lee, was he representative
at
that time?
He was representative at the time. Okay. So, and he was a master politician. Mm-hmm. Between me, you, and you. As far in the 4th and 5th Ward, they couldn't beat him. So, we decided we were going to run the doggone election. And I had a goal in my mind. There was always a bad division between the 4th and 5th Ward with the 2nd, 3rd, and 1st Ward. They would call us the French people, and we would call them the Americans.
And Nettie Kent. Yes. Wow.
We called the people from Chicago and Turkey Creek and Pont Verde the Americans. And it was a bad division. They didn't trust the French people, and we really thought the people from the 4th and 5th Ward were crude, you know, people that would work in the woods. In those days, yeah. Just not up to the social standards of, say, Arthur Lucius and Phil Platt, Mamou. But I was determined to stop that, to unite those two parts of the parish. And to this day, I'm satisfied that we are one parish. The people of Turkey Creek trust the people from Phil Platt. People from Phil Platt trust the people from Pine Prairie. And so I really believe we were one parish, and I'm glad I was part of that particular agenda. And anyway, we made the district attorney's race. And like I suspected, and that I hoped for, a revolution did occur. I carried every precinct of the parish.
Everyone?
Every last one.
Wow, that's unheard of, really.
And I had 70% of the vote against the establishment. It was a real a revolution.
But you must have worked. You must have worked day and night to do that.
When I got through campaigning, mm-hmm. when I made that last speech, I weighed 116 pounds. Because, you see, I still was growing up. After I got to be a judge, I had gotten to about 130, 135 pounds. But working night and day, making a speech in every nook and cranny, I had a schedule. I'd make a speech in Turkey Creek on a Saturday night. Then the next night I was in Chitanya, or the next night I was in Durag for every precinct, Clearwater, Durag, Beaver Creek, I made a speech in every place.
You know, Marcelo, the young people today don't understand how difficult that was to go to Durag or go to Clearwater or Blood Bend or any of those places. Or even in Bedi Cove, gravel roads, and as you said, rainy days. It was all close to impossible to get through.
So anyway, we made that race, and we were lucky to win because Mr. Puri was a real smart man and a good lawyer, probably the best lawyer in the parish.
With hindsight now, Mr. Gilroy, did he think he had it made?
Well, at first he thought that it was because he was strong, you know.
Uh-huh.
He thought it was a joke that a little young boy was running.
Okay.
But as things got a little bit closer, he realized he was in trouble. But it was too late.
Uh-huh.
It was too late. I had that organization with my Uncle Lee and Parker Fusilier and Uncle Black, who was a police juror, and several other older men, Chester Lorman, Oscar Sylvester, Percy Fontenot. I had them as a brain trust,
uh-huh.
making the organization, Mr. Oscar and Chester Lorman. And they practically financed my campaign.
Okay, folks, that concludes today's show. But in 2 weeks from now, October 15th, here on KVPI Radio, we will have the conclusion of this interview with Mr. Elo Fusilier. Thank you again. Stay tuned in 2 weeks.